Now we're in a position to understand the idea of the four sons. Well, we've established that the basic obligation of the night is to tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt, and notice that the Rambam puts the emphasis upon the discussion of the miracles, the miraculous phenomena that occurred. However, there are certain conditions that are attached to the mitzvah of telling the story. One of them is that it has to be done in a manner which fulfills the obligation of V'higar Zolavimcha, that you shall teach it to your children. So of course, as we said, if a person doesn't have children, he's not obligated because he doesn't have children, that's obvious. And he still does the mitzvah. It's not that the mitzvah itself is basically just to teach children. The mitzvah is to tell the story of the Exodus. However, if a person has children, then they become involved in his performance of the mitzvah, because he has to communicate it to his children. And as we said, the pasuk from which we learn it out is, and you shall tell it to your children on that night, saying, Bavur Zeh, because of this. Because of this is a reference to the matzah and the maror, the objects of mitzvah that are in front. And thus, the idea is to transmit the story as the foundation of the system. It's because of these events that occurred that we were given a Torah. And we have to observe the mitzvahs. It's not simply the freedom. There's an ideal of freedom, which is purely the removal, the absence of external restraints. That is not true human freedom. That would explain why this begins with Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, blessed is God, blessed is He, blessed is He who gave the Torah to His nation Israel. That serves as a perfect introduction to the four sons. Because the whole objective of the four sons is, the whole idea behind it is the transmission of the Masorah, the body of ideas of knowledge, the Torah, the whole system of Torah, which comprises knowledge, which comprises the commandments, the mitzvos, and how to perform the mitzvos. That's the real freedom. That's the real objective. The person doesn't have that, he doesn't recognize that, so then he's involved in what we would consider to be a much lower level. It's a prerequisite, obviously. Nobody should be enslaved physically. Nobody should be oppressed. That is true, but the removal from the state of oppression, the way we look at it, is a precondition to the obtainment of true human freedom. True human freedom is something which pertains to the essence of man, which is the soul. The ability of the soul to fulfill its objective, which has to do with the relationship to God, to the creator of the universe, which is based upon comprehension. In a word, the essence of Adam, of man, consists in the divine element which enables him, of all the beings that exist in the created framework, in the created universe, to have comprehension. And as a result of this comprehension, to recognize God. And of course, this comes to us only through adherence to the system of Torah. That's why before you embark on fulfilling the mitzvah of, and you shall teach it to your children, you have to have an appreciation of the fundamentals which constitute the elements of true cheiros, Baruch HaMakom, a recognition of God, the ultimate being, and all of our striving, our entire purpose in existence is to gain a knowledge of our Creator. And at the same time, to recognize what makes us unique, what makes us distinct. Well, why are we engaged and what are we telling over? What's the story? And so forth, it's all the Torah. This is the Torah. Thus, a person has to have an awareness and appreciation of the supreme value of Torah. The person does not have that. I don't like to put these things in a negative way, but I just have to do so in order to make the point. Absent an appreciation of the Torah, and the mitzvot, the system that God gave us, then what is it that we are celebrating? What is it that we are transmitting? What is it that we have that's so vitally significant? It's all based upon the Torah and a recognition of the value, the supreme value of Torah, which is because it is the Torah of God. It's God's revelation. The ultimate gift that differentiates the people that he gave La'amo Yisrael, to his own nation, to Israel. That's what it means to be part of the Jewish people. It's very relevant as well, because people get together on the night of the Seder, that sense of being a nation, of being a people. It's a family, and then you, it's not just family, but you invite friends, or even the stranger you include. The whole purpose of inviting a stranger is because he's not a stranger. It's really part of one nation. So that concept is there. You want to use the word community, whatever you want to say, but it's part of Klal Yisrael. So it's the recognition that we're not just ordinary people, that we're differentiated. And we're not differentiated because of any type of racial superiority. We don't believe in that, in racial factors. There's nothing in Judaism that recognizes racial factors. What differentiates us is the Torah. And it's also relevant, it's interesting, bit of a side note, that it's virtually impossible, if a person is rational and consistent, to develop this sense of some kind of superiority, given that, what are we talking about? Maschil b'gnus. We go back to what? We were slaves. We were slaves in Egypt. That's something that any group of people who had actually experienced something very degrading and very humiliating, and then for whatever reason were able to remove themselves and transform and become some type of a great power, they want to erase that. They don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about the degradation and the humiliation that breaks down their whole sense of glory. But to the contrary, we go back to that. Maschil b'gnos. Why? Umasayim b'shevach. That's one of the rules. That you start out with the point of degradation, and then you work your way into the praise, the shevach, the fact that God removed us from Egypt. And telling the story, you have to go back to the beginning. It's actually an argument as to whether that's the beginning in terms of Mitzchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah. At the outset, we were idol worshippers, or whether it's talking about we were slaves unto Paro. You would think it should be we were slaves unto Paro, because that's the beginning of the story. That's the beginning of the degradation. But there's another opinion that says that no, the real degradation was we, from the outset, were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, Avasayim. We come from Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Of course, the question is, which is more degrading to know? That you are a slave, you come from slaves, or you come from idol worshippers? It's very, very interesting. Well, this shows you that there are two aspects to the freedom. The freedom, the physical freedom. If you're talking in terms of the physical freedom, that aspect of it, the enslavement and the freedom, the story of the night, that's basically the story of the night. So that story begins with we were slaves unto Paro. So you talk about the sufferings, the degradation of the enslavement. But if you're talking about the other aspect of the redemption, which has to do with the geula, the achievement of real chayrus, of real freedom, and the real freedom has to do with the fact that we extricate ourselves from any kind of an enslavement, because we free the freeing of the mind through the study of the Torah. So then, the real degradation, what's the real glory, the real freedom, is knowledge. A people that's living a whole different way of life based upon knowledge and Torah. So then the real degradation would be, there's nothing more degrading than Ovdei Avodah Zarah. In fact, as we've analyzed it, to be in a state of physical enslavement in and of itself is not really the ultimate degradation. As we pointed out, many times a person, because he's removed from all temptation, from all opportunities to pursue nonsense, and very often a person that's thrown into a jail winds up living a better life. He's forced to exercise, he's only given certain kinds of foods, and I cited a case where there's no recreation, so he has to start reading books, and he has to use his mind. That's not a degradation. The real degradation is, from the standpoint of the state of humanity, the ultimate degradation, that the Adam, who was created with the divine element, the neshama, the soul, the ability to comprehend God, and to misuse that and to fall into a primitive type of an idolatry, a worship of idols, that's the ultimate degradation. That's philosophical degradation. So those are the two points of view. Are we talking about degradation from the standpoint of the way people look at it, or from the standpoint of a physical freedom and enslavement? That's a degraded status. A person has a degraded status in the framework of society. A slave is looked down upon from that point of view. But a person who has a very faulty religious ideas is not necessarily looked down upon. He can be a very significant, influential individual. But that is the reality. The ultimate human degradation, from the philosophical standpoint, would be an idolater. We incorporate both. So the point of mentioning the degradation, whether it be that we were slaves, or whether it be even worse, that we were idol worshippers, is to make it clear on a certain level that the essence of the Jewish people and the greatness of the Jewish people has nothing to do with any type of egotism, with any type of characteristics of superiority, that we're not superior. You could take a look and you'll see that we were in the most degraded state. What renders us different is the superior lifestyle that's mandated by the Torah. So the attitude one should have is one of humbleness and one of praise, to recognize God, the existence of God, and to be grateful that God selected us. And even there, it's not because of any merit that we possess, it's because of the merit of the fathers who found favor in his eyes. And that's the foundation of fulfilling the mitzvah of the night. It seems to me that a person has to be in this framework of a genuine recognition of what the Jewish people is, and a genuine commitment to the truth of Torah, what Torah is, then he can partake of the story. Then he's in the framework of one who can communicate the story, not just as a historical episode, but as something which transforms us, which achieves the real cheiros. That's the objective, because the objective is to give over the masorah from one generation to the next. But in order to do that, you've got to be a Baal HaMasorah on a certain level. You've got to be someone who partakes of this masorah. And this masorah is rooted in the idea of Torah, and that true human fulfillment and freedom is achieved only through the Torah. I want to continue a little bit along these lines, that we said that the obligation of Sipur, of telling the story, has to do with communicating it to your child. Now the Rambam says, even if the person does not have a child, so therefore it remains an independent mitzvah. The essential mitzvah is to tell over the story. If you have a child, so you have to include the child. But if you don't have a child, you still have to tell the story. Then he says, "Afilu chacham gedolim," even great sages are obligated to discuss the Exodus. And the more one is involved, to the extent increases his involvement in talking about the story, is praiseworthy. Now, we've already expressed that idea, that the mitzvah should not be construed as simply obtaining a body of knowledge. Once you have the knowledge, that's it. Rather, it is a springboard. One has to be immersed in the study and the discussion, the exploration of the ideas that pertain to this area, and that's an endless pursuit. The Rambam continues and says it's a mitzvah to teach the children, even if they did not ask. That is that one might have said that the involvement of the children only takes place not only when one has children, but when they ask the question. So therefore, if they ask the question, then you're obligated to respond. You can't put them off. But what if the children are not interested, or for whatever reason they don't ask the question? That does not exempt you from the mitzvah. And he cites the pasuk. It says, "V'yigadol l'mincha, you shall declare, you shall teach, you shall tell them," implying that it's an inherent obligation. Of course, it's better if they ask a question. That's a very significant idea. It is better that they ask a question. If you study that Gadi, you'll also get a lot of insight into the pedagogy of the Torah, the educational methodology of the Torah, which seeks to involve the student, to arouse the curiosity, the emotional curiosity of the student. It does many, many things we do in the course of the Seder. One of them that's the whole point of the karpas. The karpas is having a vegetable before the meal, and then you're supposed to remove the plate to confuse or to just arouse curiosity. In fact, you're supposed to do different things. That's just the standard thing, but once the child gets used to that, or the child may not notice it. So therefore, the child is very vital participant at the Seder, and your objective is to involve the child in a discussion. Of course, the child according to their level, that's clear. And the best way to do so is by arousing the curiosity of the child to get the child to ask a question. In my opinion, I think it might be a bit unfortunate. Maybe it's inevitable. I'm not taking a stand, but rather with the phenomenon that's developed is that the children are, so to speak, scripted. That there's so much anticipation and preparation for the Seder, and then the students are assigned different scripts or roles to play. And so therefore, what the Seder turns into is a situation where the children pull out their scripts and recite what they've been taught to recite. And whoever's there, the parents are very proud, and the grandparents, and so forth. That's fine, but that's not really the ideal. Because in that case, they're not really learning anything. You're not teaching them anything. They're just simply reciting, recitation. The real objective is to teach. And in order to teach, you have to get them interested. So one doesn't necessarily preclude the other. You have to find ways to involve them by asking a question or getting them to ask a question. And that is the real objective that one should seek to do on whatever level, to communicate something. And the way to communicate is through question and answer, to arouse the curiosity of the child. Then the Rambam says that the level... What is the level at which this discussion has to be conducted? Lefi daito shel ben aviv melamdo. The father teaches him in accordance with his understanding, his level of understanding. That's very, very significant, which works in both ways, as we'll see. The four sons includes the chacham. It's not a perfunctory thing where you just have a child and go through the motions, ask a question and tell an answer and then move on. No. It's got to be real. And if it's real, then it has to be in accordance with the person's level. So that's why it doesn't cooperate the Chacham. The Chacham is the one who's at a high intellectual level, who formulates his questions. He wants to understand the deeper ideas, the concepts, the categories. So that's the level at which he should be addressed. Of course, this presupposes the ability of the father. The father over here that we're talking about is someone, theoretically, who has more knowledge than the child. Obviously, situations develop where the child grows up, and the child can become a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, and he knows more than the father. But we're just talking in this framework. On the other hand, one should not disparage a situation where the child is on a very minimalistic type of level of understanding. Thus, the Rambam explains. How so? If he was very young, Otipesh, he was immature, foolish, immature, not sophisticated. He says to him, "My son, we were all slaves, kamo shifchazu, like this servant. It presupposes that you have a servant in the house. Sort of visual. You point out. Illustrate. Now, what if you don't have a shivcha in the house? This is very, very important. The Rambam is not just talking in general terms. Okamo evet zeh, or he says, oh, like the slave. Let's say a person in those days perhaps had a slave or a servant. We don't have that today. But listen to the formulation. We were all slaves in Egypt, like this slave. And on this night, God redeemed us. God, blessed be He, redeemed us and brought us forth to freedom. At this point, I want to raise another challenging question. As I've said, in order to make the Seder interesting, you pose questions that people would be interested in and get involved in a discussion. And you could raise this question at any point, even before you get into the actual Haggadah. Perhaps after Kiddush. And raise the question, what's the cutoff point? What degree, what would be the minimal degree of advancement, development, sophistication, at which one would be obligated to incorporate the child into the actual Seder? I'm speaking in terms of the mitzvah of Sipur, of giving over. I'm not talking about excluding any child from the Seder. Obviously, all children, if they stay up, they'll be there and they'll hear the singing, whatever, even if they don't really comprehend much. It's still a experience which will leave a certain impression. I'm not talking about that. We're talking about the mitzvah, including them, being obligated to include them, and engage in some type of an educational experience together with them. What would be the minimal requirements of the child who would be a candidate for that? In my opinion, the formula that the Rambam gave would be that the child has to be able to appreciate, to understand, even on a very minimal level, the idea of being enslaved, of a slave, and has some sense of God. That's what the formula, the basic formula is, that my child, we were all slaves, like this servant. So it means to say that the child may not be able to comprehend it in the abstract. So you have to use certain illustrations. Now I would say, therefore, that if you don't have, obviously today we don't have anybody that would fit into that category. We don't have servants or slaves. But then you would have to use some type of visual media. You could have pictures. Pictures, and show the child that is a child who has the capacity to understand this. This is what it means, show people being enslaved, people in prisons, and so on and so forth. Obviously, because it's Yom Tov, we can't do that, but if it were permitted to show videos of different cases that exhibit how people were enslaved and mistreated, then that would be the way to do it. Now, we can't do it for technical reasons, halacha, I'm fine, but you can show pictures. I think that's what the Rambam was saying. It doesn't, when the Rambam said, just like this servant. Meaning to say that even if the child doesn't get it in the abstract, and you have to actually show pictures, you have to become a teacher, like a teacher would do in class. A lot of times a teacher is trying to convey something that the child can't grasp in the abstract, and is going to try and get the idea across through the utilization of concrete illustrations. That's what you have to do. And then we're freed. Who? Through God. The Holy One, blessed be He. That is, the child is on the level where can understand, can grasp the concept on the most minimal level of there being a God. It would seem to me those two things would be required. If the child is not on that level, to grasp that there's such a thing as slavery and freedom, or to grasp the idea of God, then there's nothing that you can really communicate, even on the most minimal level. That's not to say that the child is given treats and whatever. That's a different kind of phenomenon, so that the memory of the evening will be pleasant. That's a different kind of thing. Like when even a child is very little on Shabbos, Chazal say they're supposed to give the kid sweets and treats or candies, just so that when the child grows up, there'll be a certain unconscious association of happiness and pleasantness with the day of the Shabbos. That's sort of a pre-educational phase, so to speak. But in terms of the real mitzvah, to communicate, you need a candidate who can receive the communication. I think the Rambam has just told us what constitutes the most minimal level. Then he says that if the son was grown and was wise, then he teaches him what took place in Egypt and the miracles that were wrought through Moshe Rabbeinu. And then he concludes this by saying, Hakol ufidaito shel ben. Everything really is determined by the level of the child. So that is something which is important to remember. That's your primary task. And one should seek to achieve it within the realistic limits. I don't think it's a good idea to push for too much if the child is not ready to receive too much. Well, it shouldn't be too superficial. It should be in line with the level of the child. We're continuing now with the Rambam in Perek Shavi, the seventh chapter, where he discusses at length the mitzvah of retelling the story of the Exodus. And he said that the source for the mitzvah is Zohar et Hayom Hazeh, remember this day that you left Egypt. And the term remember, in its halachic signification, is not the way we use it, just to remember something. But it means to enunciate and to express the idea that pertains to something. Question, where do we find... So the Rambam brings a source. Zohar et Yom HaShabbos, Lakacho. Remember the day of the Sabbath to sanctify it. Which means remember over there, again, doesn't mean to remember that it's Shabbos. It means remembering in a positive sense in terms of enunciating the sanctity of the day. Now, where do we find in the Torah, not in a halachic context, but the term zohar, remember, being used in this sense, not in the sense of just remembering something, but in telling over, in discussing something? Let me clarify. The term zohar, used in reference to Shabbos, used in reference to Amalek, used in reference to Pesach, does not simply mean remember, but it means to enunciate something. But we know that from the Torah Shebaal Peh, from the Oral Law. It's not clear from the sentence itself, so-called scripture itself, that that's what it means. Now I'm saying, where do you find an example in the Torah, not necessarily by halacha, which would back up the idea that the utilization of that term is not restricted just to remembering something? Yosef, when he interpreted the dream of the chief butler, and then he wanted him to do him a favor. When he got out, he says, Kim Zachor Zachartani, El Paro, if you'll remember me to Paro. When he said, if you'll remember me to Paro, he didn't mean that in his own mind he should remember him. He meant he'll tell him over the story, that he gave him a story. The story was that I was kidnapped, and I'm innocent, and even here I didn't do anything. And he had a whole story. And what he wanted him to do is remember. He didn't want the butler just to remember it in his mind, to recount. So you see that the term remembering is utilized in the sense of recounting some type of a story, which fits in perfectly with what we're saying over here. Of course, when the Torah uses the word zachar with regard to the night of the 15th, in and of itself, it doesn't have to mean recounting. All we've shown is that the term zohar, as used in the Torah, has different meanings. Sometimes it means simply to remember. Sometimes it means to recount. So, the Masorah, the oral law, teaches us that the zohar over here is to be understood in the same way as it is to be understood with regard to Shabbos, which is to enunciate. What I wanted to point out to you is that you see from other cases in the Torah that the word itself, zohar, to remember, sometimes means to recount something. We use this all the time when you're saying to a friend who's going somewhere, remember me to so-and-so. Remember me to so-and-so is to mention, to give regards, or something along those lines. Continuing now in Beis, Halacha Beis, the Rambam establishes that it is a mitzvah to teach it to your child, to your son. And he delineates the minimal level at which one would be obligated to do so. And I've expressed my opinion as to what that would be.
he says that even if the child is very young or undeveloped, tipesh, literally a fool, but he doesn't mean it. Child's a fool, he just means that he's immature, undeveloped. He too comes under the focus of the mitzvah. You're supposed to tell him the story. And on a very, very fundamental, elementary level, by telling him, my son, we were all slaves, like this particular servant. Now the assumption is that in his household he has someone that would be akin, a servant, akin to what we're talking about. That is someone that doesn't really have freedom. And in God redeemed us. We were all enslaved like this person, and God redeemed us from Egypt on this night and brought us forth to freedom. Thus I concluded that the child at least has to be on a level where the child can understand the idea of being free, as opposed to enslaved, even if it has to be done through illustrations. The Rambam, you have to use illustrations then. If the child could understand the concept, but not in the abstract, but only through certain pictures. So the Rambam used the illustration of actually if you have someone who's akin to a slave in your house working for you. We don't usually have that kind of thing today. Obviously, we don't have even servants. Most people don't have servants. And the idea of a servant, really, I don't know if it would equate. That wouldn't get the message across. Thus, you should use pictures, books, illustrated material. Obviously, because it's Yom Tov, as I've said, we can't use videos, television or movies, things of that sort. But if there were not such a problem, if you didn't have that problem, then you could put on a video and a demonstration of people who are enslaved by a cruel oppressor, and then the child would understand it. And you point out to the child, that's the situation that we were in. God took us out on this night. God freed us, liberated. So if the child has those two concepts of slavery and liberation, and also the idea of God, that God, that's the vital component, would seem that way. To simply say that on this night, we were liberated, but let's say the child doesn't understand the idea of God. The child could understand the idea of being enslaved and being freed, but really couldn't understand the idea of God. So my question is, would you still be obligated to tell the story? I want to point out that this is a mitzvah. If you have a child that's not old enough to understand the elementary idea that the Rambam has stated, then you don't have the mitzvah to teach that child. You would bring him to the Seder and let him get a little flavor. It makes an impression on his unconscious. So when he gets older, he's drawn, he wants to come back to it. That's very, very important. That even when a child is not on the level of understanding, there's a different type of education that we should employ. Chazal speak about this, that little children, on Shabbos, for example, you're supposed to give them special treats that they ordinarily wouldn't have, even if they don't understand what Shabbos is about. And of course the same would be true about the holidays. Even if they don't understand what it would be about. What's the reason? You're sort of preparing them. Chazal understood the power of unconscious impressions. They understood the significance of the early years of childhood. Psychology now is first beginning to recognize that people sometimes can suffer the rest of their adult life. And if you trace it back, it's really something which the people themselves don't even understand what it is that's bothering them. They have certain types of fears, some types of inhibitions, certain types of anxieties, and they try and trace in their own memory what does it go back to, and they reach a blank. Because generally speaking, the first few years of childhood have been erased from most people's memories. You have to have access to it through special techniques, perhaps. It's called free association and the like. However, very often, it is because of certain type of so-called psychological traumas that were experienced in these early years when the psyche really wasn't mature enough to handle them, to deal with it. So it's different if something of major impact happens to a person when they're older. You see the effects. It can cause a person to become depressed and anxious and so on and so forth. However, the person has more resources can deal with it because the mind is more mature, so you can put it into a certain context, into a certain perspective, you can deal with it, you can get over it. But the child doesn't have those kinds of tools, so very often the child simply represses it, and once it's repressed, it has an impact upon the mind. There's a loss. There's a loss, and it can come back to haunt the person, which is to say that the earliest impressions of childhood should not be disregarded, should not be regarded as inconsequential, simply because the child has no way of expressing it. The child and the adult has no way of understanding it. Therefore, you could say certain things to a child. You could do certain things to a child. And you may see an immediate effect, but the next day the child is not going to be talking about it or reflecting it. And you just assume that it just bounces off. Most people, I think, have that assumption. That pleasure or pain just bounces off the child. It doesn't become internalized in the child. That is not the case. It's not true psychologically. And you see with regard to the approach of Chazal that there are very powerful associations in the unconscious. So that, therefore, Shabbos, the child, in his earliest experiences, when he can relate to Shabbos, he comes to the table, and it's pleasant, and his parents give him certain treats. So, when he gets older, of course, the mind comes into the picture. There's no guarantee that he's going to be observant and want to keep the Shabbos. However, all things being equal, from a purely psychological standpoint, he's going to gravitate towards it because there's association. He's going to associate this with pleasure. So the same would apply over here, that there is a pre-educational approach, pleasant associations. All things being equal, that makes it easier later on. Of course, in and of itself, it's not sufficient because the child grows up and starts to ask questions. You have to give them an education. It's got to make sense. I don't think a child is going to be observant for the rest of their life simply because when they were children it was pleasant. But it's a good starting point. There's no doubt in my mind that everything the Rambam said here is essence of the formula of what would constitute, at the most minimal level, fulfillment of the mitzvah of v'yigadzelavincha, you shall tell it to your children. If the child, theoretically speaking, if a child could understand the state of being enslaved, oppressed, and then being freed from it, but didn't understand the idea of God, then that is not fulfilling, and you shall tell it to your children. Because that's not the story of Pesach. The story of Pesach is not, as most people imagine, that a people were enslaved and became free. As we'll see, the idea of freedom, we've discussed this, the idea of freedom that the God is talking about is not the same as the idea that most people have. Most people's idea of freedom simply relates to a person being externally locked up. And if you're not in jail, if you're free, that to them that's freedom. That's not the Torah's idea. Aside from that, however, the story is not that the Jews became free. The story is that God redeemed us, that God freed us. That's vital. If a person doesn't have that idea, I could raise the question on a different level. If a person is not so sure about his belief in God, but this he believes for whatever, because he confirmed it through historical sources. Could a person who doesn't believe that this was the work of God, could a person who believes that this is true, that the Jews were enslaved and the Jews managed to get out somehow or other, but it's not sure that God is responsible for doing it, could that person have the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim?
No.
Also
doesn't acknowledge God.
It doesn't acknowledge God. He may acknowledge the history, then it's a different story. That is not the story we're talking about. The fact that it was the Jews, the fact they were enslaved, the fact they were freed, sure, there are elements of the story, there are accents of the story, but the real story is that God redeemed us. So therefore, as far as the child is concerned, the obligation to tell to your child comes into force when the child is capable of understanding all of these elements, that God redeemed us. In fact, that is the essence of the fact that we were slaves and became free is just a backdrop.
That's what he was mentioning at all.
V'yim hoya ha-ben gadol v'chacham, And if the child was mature and a chacham, a wise son, modio mashi'ir lano b'mitzrayim, he informs them what happened to us in Egypt. V'nisim shenasu lano al yidei Moshe Rabbeinu, and the miracles that were done for us through Moshe Rabbeinu, hakol l'fidaiton shelben, everything in accordance with the level of the sun. Notice that this is more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Notice that this contains the basic elements of the sefer, that it's not just a bare minimum story, enslaved, freed because of God, but more, what occurred to us, what happened, and the focus on the miracles that came about through Moshe Rabbeinu. That's a much more sophisticated discussion. And then, of course, he says, "Akol l'fidaiton shelben," everything in accordance with the level of understanding of a child. It's interesting to note that in the paragraph in the Haggadah, which talks about the four sons, and it mentions the Chacham, and the question of the Chacham, which pertains, it seems, more to the halachic structure of the mitzvahs of the evening. Turning now to Chacham Mahu Omer, what does the Chacham say? Moho Eidos V'achukim V'amishpatim. What are these testimonies, statutes, judgments? It's a reference to the different categories of the commandments. Ashetziva Adoshem Elokenu Peschem, that the Lord our God commanded you. That is the question. The Afato Emorlo Kilchos Pesach. And also you should explain to him the laws of the Pesach. Maftirin Achra Pesach Afikomai, that we do not eat anything, any type of dessert after the eating of the Pesach, that the eating of the Pesach sacrifice at the time when it applied was the last thing that was eaten that night. The first thing we notice is that this does not seem to correspond to that which the Rama mentioned. The Rama didn't say that you tell him about the Hilchos of Pesach. He emphasized the basics of the story that has to do with the freedom from the slavery, and to a greater extent the explanation of what took place and the miracles that were done through Moshe and so forth. That's the narrative. Doesn't at all mention anything about the halachos. The real question I would ask in terms of the Chacham, what does it have to do with the Pesach, and what does it have to do with the mitzvah of Vigar Levincha that you shall tell to your children? He's asking a question about mitzvahs. It seems to be about mitzvahs in general. It's a different kind of a question. That question can come up anytime. There's a big problem in understanding the section pertaining to the Chacham. It's not clear what this has to do with the night of Pesach. It's not clear what the answer has to do with the basic mitzvah, to tell him about the Exodus. Now the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah said that the mitzvah of Vigarta Levincha, that you shall tell to your children, what are you supposed to tell to your children? You're supposed to tell them the story of what took place, either on a simple level or on a sophisticated level. But he doesn't mention it, but to tell him about halachos, that's something else. You're supposed to teach your child halachos, of course. That's something else. But what does that have to do with the mitzvah of Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim, recounting the Exodus? I'm going to quote now from the Haggadah called Siach HaGrid, which is a compilation of explanations that were given by Rav Soloveitchik as a Zichrono Livracha, which is an excellent Haggadah. I'm quoting now from the commentary. I'm translating it. That he says, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik says, that we learn from the parsha of the wise son that regarding the mitzvah of Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim, to tell the story of the Exodus, in addition to telling about the narrative, the events that occurred, it is also necessary to learn the Hilchos HaPesach. It's another component. There are different components pertaining to the mitzvah, as you see, in the Haggadah itself, the element of Torah. In fact, that's why we have the what constitutes a blessing for the Torah. Blessed is he who gave Torah to his nation Israel. We have to tell the story. We have to recount the story in our own words, but we also have to recount the story through the passages in the Torah and the appropriate means of what is called drasha, the exegesis. That occupies a significant part of the Haggadah. We take that parsha called Arami Oved Avi, which encapsulates the basic story, plus the way in which the rabbis of the Talmud explained it, elucidated it, the drushos. So that's Talmud Torah, that's the study of Torah. So you see that there are different elements that we have to engage in order to fulfill the mitzvah properly. And now we see from the Chacham that part of the mitzvah is to express the ideas through the explanation of the mitzvahs of that night. The signification of the matzah, the significance of the morah, the significance of the Korban Pesach. That too is part of the body of knowledge. It would be lacking if we just restricted ourselves to a historical narrative. The idea, of course, that the story is intrinsically connected to the mitzvahs that we're about to perform. Bavur Zeh, because of this. The story is told in conjunction with the mitzvahs. So part of the objective is to study the mitzvahs and to see how they reflect the basic ideas of the story. We do that when we point out to these three things. Matzah, in fact, that's vital. Everybody must make a point of saying that. Whoever did not say these three things, matzah, Pesach, matzah, and maror, did not fulfill his obligation. And then you proceed to explain the significance of each one of these three things. What's the idea? The idea is that if a person just knows the historical but doesn't connect the historical to the system of mitzvos, and specifically the particular mitzvos that are directly related to what takes place in Pesach, didn't fulfill his mitzvah properly. So apparently, the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, where he's talking about the mitzvah of Sipur, of telling the story, is focusing, with regard to V'higadot HaLimcha, is focusing essentially on the basic. The essential mitzvah is the story of the miracles, the enslavement, the miracles, the freedom. That, he's saying, will be on different levels. But in the Haggadah, it's going beyond that. It uses the example of the Chacham, of the wise son, as an opportunity to go beyond that and to illustrate the fact that you also have to be involved in studying the significance of the mitzvahs, the meaning of the mitzvahs. And that is with regard to the Ben, who is the Chacham, the wise son. And in fact, that's his primary curiosity. His primary curiosity relates to the mitzvahs that you're involved in on that night. And you could see from the way he formulates his question that he's a thinker. That he doesn't just ask on impulse. It's like before he even asks a question, he focuses, he studies, he formulates, he observes. He has a respect for the phenomena, and he observes, and he categorizes and classifies into distinct categories. He sees that there are certain things that are eidos, that are testimonies. He sees that there are certain things that should be classified as chukim, statutes. That certain things should be classified as mishpatim. Of course, in the Torah itself, it's talking about someone who's questioning the whole system of Torah. But here, it's with regard to the mitzvahs that pertain that evening. So the af, and also you should tell him Kilchos a Pesach, the laws of the Pesach, in addition to the Sefer. Of course, it doesn't mean that the Ben Chacham, you don't tell the Sefer. That wouldn't make any sense. You don't tell him the story. Of course you tell him the story. That's what the Rambam is focusing on. The primary obligation is to convey the story. That's why the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah is talking about that. That's your primary obligation. And you do that on different levels. And therefore, he's talking over there about the Chacham in terms of the primary story. The Haggadah, however, is making an additional point. And that is that the children are incorporated as well in this further element of Sipur. That the Sipur has to also encompass the explanation for the mitzvos halayla. That's what the Baal Haggadah is talking about. But there's no question that the primary obligation is, as the Rambam said, the telling of the story, the narrative. The reason for explaining the mitzvos halayla, the mitzvos that pertain to that night, are extremely important, and they're intertwined with the telling of the story. The pasuk itself says, "Vigartel mincha v'yom ahulem," or you shall tell your child on that day, saying, "Ba'avur zeh," because of this. Because of this, what is this? This is the mitzvahs. So the idea that God redeemed us for the sake of performing the mitzvahs is a vital element, it's a vital component of the Sipur. Thus, one has to be able to show the connection. What's the connection between the one and the other? And then you have to explain that the mitzvahs are not arbitrary, not whimsical, but they contain deep wisdom. They have a signification, and that's what we do indeed at the Seder. You point out to each object and explain the reason for the object. Of course, that explanation again is on a rudimentary level, simplistic level. That's the minimal obligation. The more sophisticated you are, the more you go into it. What's interesting to note is that the Rambam omits the idea of the Rasha, the wicked son. Doesn't mention him at all. Yet we do find in the Haggadah, the second paragraph pertains to the Rasha. It mentions what does the Rasha say, raises this question, and what you're supposed to answer him. Which would indicate that the Rasha is not to be excluded. He also has a role to play. Yet the Rambam doesn't mention him. There are different answers that are brought down pertaining to this question. I'd like to offer my own opinion. And that is that the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah is talking about those children with whom one fulfills the mitzvah of V'igadta L'mincha, you shall tell it to your children. Which is to say that that is part of the mitzvah of telling the story. So through this discussion with your child, you are involved in teaching the story. Thus, we have to know the different types of child, the different levels, the different approaches. However, there is the phenomenon of the so-called Rasha, the wicked son. What defines him as being wicked is the element of denial, does not accept the Torah as being true. That we can deduce from the wording. Actually, if you take a look at the question, it doesn't seem to be that much different than the question of the Chacham, the wise son. The Rasha says, Mohavoda Hazos, what is this worship? Lachem, to you. What is the signification of this worship to you? That seems to be, on the surface, a respectful, innocuous kind of a question. It doesn't seem such a terrible question. And it's not altogether clear what is it over here that renders him into a Rasha. The plain sense of the pasuk, as it's brought down in the Chumash, is not any indication that of something wicked in the question. This is brought down in conjunction with the command that was given to the Jews in Egypt to prepare for the night of the 15th and to bring the Passover sacrifices and all of the different activities that were associated with it. And then at the end, Chafhei, after the description of the Passover sacrifice in Egypt, it says that when you come to the land that the Lord your God will give you, as he said, that is, when you come to the land of Israel, you shall guard this avodah, this service. It's a sacrificial service. Meaning to say that this is not being commanded just now as you leave Egypt, but it'll be a permanent feature. Something which you will do every year when you enter into the land that God promised. In conjunction with that, it says, and it'll be when your sons will say to you, what is this, the significance of this avodah to you? And you will say, it is a Passover sacrifice to God, in that he skipped over, so to speak, on the Jewish houses in Egypt, but not Poes Mitzrayim, when he slew, when he smote the Egyptians, Vespotenu Hitzil, and he saved our houses. That's basically the answer. So there's no indication in the Torah itself that there's anything remiss about it. It's an anticipation that the child will want to know what is the point of doing it now. And you're supposed to explain them. This, however, has been selected as the basis for the question of the Russia. The claim shot of the Pasuk, the Chumash, is not that there's anything wicked about this question. It's a question, no, because first of all, it's not a question which is emanating from anyone. The Torah is telling you that when you come to the land, your children will ask you this question. It's not telling you when you come to the land that your children are going to rebel. In fact, upon hearing this news, it says the people bowed with gratitude. And Rashi says that the reason why they bowed is because it contained the promise that they would enter the land and they would have children. Rashi says that the reason for the bowing was Psuras HaGeula, that the news that they would be redeemed, Ubiyas HaAretz, and the fact they would enter the land, Ubsoras HaBonim, and the news, information, that HaBonim Shiulam, that they would have children in the land. Now, obviously, if it was a forecasting that they would have wicked children, there would be nothing to praise, to be happy about. The idea of the Russia is based upon a certain implication which fits into the word. You can use the pasuk to get across the idea. And it's basically the word lachem. What is this service to you? What is the significance of this service to you? On the surface, there's nothing wrong with that, because you're the ones that are doing the service, and the child is the one that wants to understand. The implication, however, is lachem below low, that the way it's being expressed implies an idea, and the idea is that it's only for you. It has been explained, I believe Rabbi Chaim explained a number of years ago, that what he's really expressing, the viewpoint he's expressing, is something which is, it's an idea that affects people in all time, especially in our time, that is relativism. It's to you. It's a certain curiosity. That is to say that he's interested. There are people who are interested in the different practices of different people, religious practices, for example. And there are people today that themselves do not believe in Judaism. They may have attached some value to it. It may be nice. It's of interest. It's curious. So they'll come to your house, for example, and they'll ask, why do you do this on Shabbos? Or why do you refrain? What's the reason for this? But they're asking in the framework of what significance, what value does it have to you? It's not universal. They're not acknowledging that this is a system that is based upon universal and absolute truths, which exactly is the claim of Judaism. They don't believe that. But they're curious. Different people have different practices. And they may be very respectful. They may believe that Judaism is more sophisticated, on a higher level, more advanced. But it's not for them. They're asking it from this perspective of being an outsider. It doesn't pertain to them. They've separated themselves. And it's a curiosity. That's why the rush over here is not necessarily someone who's being disrespectful. But merely by this insinuation that it's subjective, and everybody's got their own truth. That's a very popular view today, pretty much. That seems to be the basic philosophy in America on the campuses. It comes through in any type of... I'm not talking about sciences. I'm talking about the so-called social sciences, or the idea of philosophy. I don't think anyone today maintains that there's objective truths in the realm of human values and philosophy. To the contrary, it's all subjective. And that's why they can't maintain that one society is necessarily better than the other society. It has a lot to do on the political level. When it boils down to the political level, it does lead into this thing of being not the patriotic and democratic, patriotic to your own country. Because who are you to say that your way of life is correct and the other way of life is wrong? You have a lot of that idea. Relativism. You can't say that Iraq is wrong. You can't say that this country is wrong. Communism is wrong. This is yours. You believe in it. They believe in that. And you can't get beyond that. You can't get involved in a world of truth, because they maintain there is no such thing. There's no reality in this realm. If there's no reality in this realm, so then it's all relative. This is contrary to the idea of Judaism, which maintains the Torah is from God, and this is objective truth. All of the ideas of the Torah, the values of the Torah, the principles of the Torah, are not subjective. They're objective. They're that which is true and that which is good for Adam, for God's creation, for man, not just for Jews necessarily. The system that God gave the Jews is different than the system that God demanded the other nations should observe, a different level. However, the ideas of the Torah are objectively true. And the Russia is one who denies objective truth. So that, therefore, this person maintains there is no truth. There is no God. So it's all the human emotion. Man is the measure of all things. Whatever you feel. Of course, they have certain constraints on that. That is to say, the one thing they'll acknowledge is, as long as you don't hurt anybody, or as long as you don't impose your view on somebody else, that's the only evil, it turns out. Which is not consistent, because if that's from a subjective standpoint, if that's what you believe, that you should, that your belief system is that people should have the right to impose their view, so why shouldn't you be allowed to do that? I'm not getting into that. That's a different issue. It can't be completely consistent, because once you maintain a subjectivism, if you maintain that that's the ideal, that's the ultimate reality is subjectivistic, so then it just doesn't work, because people will destroy each other. On a practical level, it doesn't work. You can't say that there's anything wrong with a Hitler. Because from a subjective standpoint, that's he believed in that with great fervor, and you're maintaining there's no such thing as right and wrong on an objective level. So you believe in the democratic rights, everybody should have the right to express their opinion, and he doesn't. He believes that no one should have the right to express their opinion except him. So according to your system, once you're saying subjective, that his view is equally valid as your view, so then by definition, either there's going to be war. You're not going to submit to him because your view is contrary to that. He's not going to submit to you because his view is contrary to your view, so they got an endless war. Doesn't work on a practical level. Moreover, it doesn't work on a psychological level, because none of these people are going to go along with that. That is to say, while they deny that there's such a thing as evil, they don't like that word. There's such a thing as evil on an objective level. But when they encounter something which they despise, such as Nazism, that type of thing. People who oppress anything which, according to their emotions, is despicable, they will label it that way. They have no choice. There's no way that they can stand idly by. Of course, another consequence is that they shouldn't interfere with those societies in which this is done. It leads them to the position where they have to stand idly by and allow millions of people to be slaughtered, because that's the way that society works. That's what it believes in. And other forms of oppression. But that's not true psychologically, because psychologically they have tremendous hatred for those things that they dislike. You see, like the anti-war protesters right now. On the one hand, they may proclaim there's no such thing as truth, but you see the vehemence and the anger and the aggressiveness against the society which is involved in war. But why? This is what the society believes. Our society, according to its duly elected leaders, the whole course by which decisions are made, has arrived at this conclusion. So as far as our society is concerned, from a purely subjective standpoint, this is what we've decided to do. Why should they be upset? Now they may say because it contradicts their subjective views, but they're not the majority. And subjectively speaking, again, our society believes that you go by the majority. This pasuk is very good for the purpose of the Baal HaGadol, because of the fact that it's very subtle. On the surface, it doesn't seem to be anything wrong. But that's precisely the point, that most people associate a Russia, evil, wicked, with something much more blatant, with some taking a stand and openly trying to destroy something. The Baal HaGadol, the one who wrote the HaGadol, is trying to tell you that there's something more elementary than that, that it all begins, as far as the Torah is concerned, with a person's attitude towards reality, towards the truth. And that this position, which seems innocuous, that there is no such thing as truth, that is the root of all evil. That's the point that I'm trying to make. Once you establish that, what you're really saying is that man's feelings, man is the measure of all things. That the truth, there is no objective truth, there is no idea, there's no value that all of mankind has to live up to. So then basically you're saying whatever people believe at any given moment is the truth. That's the destruction of Adam. Because it means to say that the world of beliefs and values or ideas that he lives by will be the world of his imagination, of his feelings. And once that's the case, there's no purpose in Adam, because the essence of Adam is the divine element, the Tzelem Elokim, the capacity to discover the truth. This is a very, very subtle point, but that is the origin, the genesis, so to speak. That's where the root of evil lies, in man's negation of an objective reality, which can be apprehended through the proper utilization of his divinely ordained intelligence, the so-called Tzelem Elokim. And the real idolatry begins with the notion that man's feelings about life, the instinctual, emotional, imaginary element within him should be the dominant one in determining how he should live his life. That's the root of all evil. Thus, my resolution of the seeming conflict between the Rambam and the Haggadah is that the Rambam is talking about someone with whom one can fulfill the mitzvah of the telling of the story. A child with whom one can fulfill the mitzvah. And thus he said that the child, even if he's young, even if he's not developed, you can tell him the story on a elementary level. But as we said before, you cannot tell the story without reference to God. This is not a historical experience. It's outside of history. It's God's intervention into human history, which brings it to a totally different level. Thus, one who is kofar, one who denies, one who is a heretic, negates this aspect. A person does not believe in God. A person does not believe in the literal truth of what the Torah is describing. then that person cannot partake of this mitzvah. Thus, the Rambam doesn't mention the Rasha. Because the Haggadah is going to tell you how to deal with it, how to answer, how to refute. But a refutation is only a refutation. If the refutation is successful, so then you may be dealing with a Chacham. He'll fall into one of the other categories. Most probably Chacham, because people who rebel intellectually are intelligent. It's not a lack of intelligence. However, what the Haggadah is telling you is that when you come to the Seder, and the objective is to give over, to transmit the entire basis of Judaism, the written law, the oral law, so therefore you have to be prepared to deal with all the different types of questions, and you have to be able to defend the system of Torah. You have to be able to break down the challenges against Torah. Thus, if such a question should arise, the Haggadah is giving you advice on how to deal with it. That's your obligation. Once there's a mitzvah of Vigad Talimcha to tell your children, then it becomes an obligation for you to be able to deal with those questions that deny the entire system. However, the Rambam doesn't include it because the content that the Haggadah is mentioning over here, the breakdown of the Rasha, is that while it's essential and you're obligated to do it, in and of itself does not fulfill the mitzvah of telling the story. It's a prelude. If it's successful and you win him over, so then you'll fulfill with him the mitzvah of the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim.
For who? For young kids.
With regard to the interpretation that we mentioned, that's brought down in the Siach HaGrid Haggadah, which he attributes to the Gra, that the question of the Rasha is not answered, we don't really answer. According to the Gra, we don't answer the Rasha. And the problem is because the pasuk that's cited is the answer that's given with regard to the Ben Rasha, but rather the child who doesn't know how to ask. So therefore, the conclusion is that you don't address the Rasha, but rather you address the other children who are there. And that's why it's in the third person. Had he been there, he wouldn't have been redeemed. Instead of saying, if you're going to speak to him directly, you'd be talking to him in the second person. Had you been there, you would not have been redeemed. I find that pshat difficult to understand. I'll just state my questions. Obviously, I'm not saying that I disagree with the Gra. That would be chutzpah. But we have a right to analyze it and just leave it as the questions. These are the things that I don't understand about that pshat. If that's the case, that you don't confront the Rasha, so why is this whole thing mentioned? Why not address him? Or just ignore him? Or don't bring it up then? Why is it being brought down in the Haggadah? Why do we need to know what the Rasha says if we're not going to address him? If we're just going to deal with those children that accept the premises of the system?
Although you have to know who not to address.
If you take a look at the paragraph, it also mentions the Afata HaKeyashinov. And you're commanded to, so to speak, knock his teeth, break his teeth, however you want to translate it, and say to him, "V'amar lo," and say to him. So how are you going to translate that? Say about him? "V'amar lo" seems to mean you're speaking to him. And what do you say to him? "V'avorza asar Hashem li." But say Simi Mitzrayim. It is interesting, of course, that the paragraph does end with Ilu Hoyasham. Had he been there, Lo Hoyenigal, he would not have been redeemed. That's a question one should ask. If we're talking directly to the Rasha, so why isn't it in the second person? Fine. We have to try and analyze it. But it's very difficult to understand that somebody would ask a question and he's to be completely ignored, and you speak to the others about him in his presence. What's the point of that? I'll try and give my explanation of the difficulties in the language, because there are difficulties in the language according to the way we're interpreting it. If you don't interpret it like the Gemara and you interpret it as a direct rejoinder to the Russia, you still have a problem, because in the answer it says li velo lo, me and not him, third person. So if that's the case, why are we referring to the Russia in the third person and not in the second person? You have to deal with that. In my opinion, you have to read the paragraph in the correct manner. I don't think that it's literal in the sense that it's telling you that this is the wording, this is what the Rosh is going to say. How is that possible? How can anybody predict exactly what the Rosh is going to say? This is not written with prophecy. And people speak differently. People express themselves differently. So we have this one particular Russia out there, and he visits different Siddharam at different times, and this is what he says. The Haggadah is giving you an overview, preparing you for the confrontation with the Russia. This fits in with the explanation that we gave yesterday. But that's not the plain meaning of the Pasuk. The plain meaning of the Pasuk, it's in the context of the bringing of the Passover sacrifice, and it'll be when your children will ask, what is this Avoda? What is the meaning of this service? Which is a perfectly good question. There's nothing in the question itself that implies denial in and of itself. However, it could be utilized. If you come at it from a different angle, you could see that the basis of heresy, of denial, is in that particular word, lachem. If indeed a person takes that literally, that it's for you, but not for me. So, that's what it's saying. What does the Russia say? Now, when it says, what does the Russia say, we're not talking specifically what the exact question, the exact words. He may ask many, many different questions, but it'll all boil down to the same idea. What's troubling him is the fact that there's no truth. That's his premise. His premise is that it's a subjectivism. That's the basic idea. That's what he wants to convey to you. He's talking about the Russia in general, the so-called intellectual. And as we mentioned, you find it on all the campuses today, the professors. Basic, whatever the particular happens to be, they get involved in particular arguments. But what's the point of the particular arguments? Underneath it all, they're maintaining that there's no truth. There's no objective truth. There's no objective reality in the world of morals. Whether they maintain that there's objective truth in other realms, I'm not sure. But certainly in this realm. In the realm of religion, for sure. So how could you say that this is true? So then there's curiosity. Curiosity is just emotional. What does it mean to you? As we said, they may even like it. That's why they're at the Seder. Why wouldn't they be at the Seder? It's fun. Religion is nice. It's inspiring. It makes you feel good. They're not even against religion. They enjoy it. And they'll say that it's valuable to a society. As long as we make it very, very clear that we're not too serious about this. We're not talking here in terms of the realm of truth and knowledge. That's what the Russia says. That's his whole attitude. That's his whole approach. So therefore, they cited a pasuk, which, to a certain extent, can be utilized to get across this idea. It'll be when you'll come into the land and you'll do the avoda, so somebody will approach you. Not everybody that raises this question has negative thoughts. No. But the way the question is phrased is big enough to incorporate even those who have curiosity. That's what it's trying to point out. that the service that you do will evoke curiosity. And that's good, because as a result of the curiosity, you'll have the opportunity to teach. So therefore, you see that the mitzvahs that are given, especially those pertaining to Pesach, have a dual purpose. The mitzvah itself, the benefits in performing it, but also to evoke curiosity. And that's the whole idea of the Seder. You see, these mitzvahs were designed with that intention. That's why it's telling you. In the parsha, when it's commanding the mitzvah, which you don't find by other mitzvahs, that the mitzvah is commanded, and then it says, and when your children will ask, why you put this tefillin on? It doesn't have anything like that. That's a different phenomenon. Of course you have to teach the child the mitzvah, you have to teach him the ideas, the philosophy. Here, the mitzvahs that attend to the observance of Pesach are integrally connected to that purpose, have that purpose as well, to evoke the curiosity. So that's why it said it'll be, you'll do the Passover sacrifice, it'll evoke a curiosity. Because of features, different features, it is different than any other carbon. We're not going into those particularities. So he's telling you that your children will ask you. And that's fine. But within that general question, there will be an implication, because some people will ask from the standpoint purely of the subjectivist approach. What does it mean to you? And deny that there's any absolute truth over here. That's the, as we've said, that's the definition of the Rasha. I want to repeat, the plain meaning of the Pasuk does not imply negation. However, the Pasuk was framed in such a way, since it's intended to be universal, that all different types of people will ask this question, it also contained that implication of those who will be asking it purely from the standpoint of understanding what it means to you, the subjectivist approach. In my opinion, this is the way the paragraph ought to be read. Rosh Maho Omer, this is the Baal HaGadah is talking to the one who's in charge of the Seder, who's running the Seder. He's not quoting the exact words of the Rasha. He's telling you the approach of the Rasha, the philosophy, which is contained in that statement, subjectivism. And then he defines that, Lefi Shehotzi is Atzom in HaKlal. That emphasizes, since he removes himself from the Klal, Kafar Ba'ikar. This is Kfira. The essence of the Torah is not, it's not enough to simply say I'm proud to be Jewish and I identify with it and I enjoy the Jewish religion, the meaning, the symbolism, the values, but I don't believe that it's a system of objective truth. If a person takes that position, even though he may be practicing, it's a kofar. He's a kofar. At your Seder, if you choose to stop at this point, there's many points where you might choose to stop and have a discussion, you could raise this question. This is a very good question. Why is that? If a person, most people believe that if a person negates the Torah, if he doesn't observe, doesn't practice, he separates himself in that way, then he's not part of the Jewish people, and that's what they would regard as heresy. But to use the term Russia to apply to someone who could be a very warm, loving, helpful, friendly, happy Jew who observes. According to this, there are people that will sing the songs, will say the prayers, will observe. But they could still have this attitude. Admittedly, in general, people that have a very serious negation, disagreement, they don't believe that it's true. Generally speaking, it's not going to produce someone who's going to be that observant. But you can have people that recognize the value. That's the subjectivist. You have to be prepared for that. Most of the time, we envision a Russia as being someone who separates himself, who's a violator, who breaks the laws. However, the way we're interpreting it, it doesn't have to be that way. You do find people like that. I don't know about orthodoxy, but I guess as it tends to become more liberal, whether it's very modern orthodoxy, conservative, or even reform, within those movements where they don't affirm the absolute truth of the Torah, but they want to accord it a high degree of significance, and they use terms like it's inspired and so meaningful and has such value that we embrace it and we love it. And they do a lot of the so-called rituals or mitzvah, whatever they do. But not from the standpoint that this is absolute truth. So you do have people like that. But they're very vehement about that. They're very happy with it, and they want it to be performed with one condition. Don't talk to me about truth. They are vociferous. And to the same extent that we are vigilant in maintaining that it is absolute truth, it's not just that they don't want to recognize it as truth, but the fact that it's not truth is something which they affirm with great vigilance. That's where they'll fight. Anyways, where's the element of kfirah? Why is that so terrible? Let's say, okay, they're wrong, because the Torah is more than that. But here he's not just saying that they're wrong. I believe that if people are honest and they read this paragraph honestly at their Seder, people that don't believe in the absolute truthfulness of the Torah will have a tough time with this. Because I think it's speaking about a lot of Jews who are going to be at the Seder itself and who would not regard this as applying to them. Now let us follow this series of ideas. It makes the point, it explains to you over here. In the first paragraph, it does not explain to you what it is about the question that renders the one who asks it a chacham. That's something we pretty much could see for ourselves. In the other paragraphs, the time and the one who doesn't know how to ask, there's no explanation as to what it is that makes him what he is. This is the only paragraph which contains an explanation as to why this seemingly innocuous question renders the person into a wicked son, into a Russia. Lefisha Hosi Esas Haman HaKlal, because he separated himself. And separating himself over here would seem to be because he's denied the truth, that this is truth. Kafar Beikar. And that's the first thing you have to recognize. That's a teaching. That's a very significant teaching. You could pause right there. The Baal HaGadol saw fit to tell you that. Why did he have to tell you that? Precisely because many people wouldn't see that that's such a terrible thing. That's kfirah. Because they would say that as long as you observe, as long as you're part of it for other reasons, emotional attachments, pragmatic factors, practical benefits. Now, it's the af ata. It's not enough for you just to realize this lesson of kfirah. You see, the night of the Seder is the night of the transmission of the Masorah, of the entire system of Judaism. That's your obligation. Therefore, you have to know the parameters. You have to know the framework, what's legitimate and what's not legitimate. What's the boundary line? The boundary line with regard to positions, there will be people that will stay within the fold, because obviously if a person leaves the fold, if he doesn't come to the Seder, so he's left the fold. So what do we know that he's a kofar? That's not a hard one to figure out. But you have to know the boundary lines, which positions are acceptable and which positions are regarded as kfirah. That's very, very, very important to know. So it tells you that. Kafar bi'ikar. This is kfirah. This is heresy. The af. Now, okay, so is it enough that I just recognize it as heresy? Or am I obligated to do something about it? That's a very important question. It says, Hake Yashinov, to hit him on the teeth, or to to weaken, to blunt, I think the way it's translated is to blunt the force of his argument. Ve'amor lo, and say unto him, Bavurze Asar Hashem li b'tseisi mimitzrayim. That's the answer. The Baal HaGadah is using two different psukim. One pasuk indicates or contains within it the framework of the idea of the question of the Rashi, as we've said. The question was formulated in such a way that it would encompass every different possibility of why a person would ask the question, including the one who approaches it from the subjectivist point of view. When it says, you say to him, Bavur ze, Asar Hashem li, B'tseisi mimitzrayim, it's giving you the basic idea of the answer. That is to say, that this is not a subjective system that people developed or that evolved out of people's religious imagination. This is something that has been ordained by the creator of the universe. These things have objective signification. They come into being not because of any significance or meaning or nostalgia, but they come into being because they're the very objective for which the creator of the universe intervened in the course of history and removed us from Egypt. That's the whole significance of what's going on over here, which is a completely different approach. Everything that we're doing over here is based upon the objective reality, because God ordained these mitzvos, and it's only because of this that he intervened and took us out of Egypt. Just like inciting the question, it doesn't cite the specific wording of the Rasha, so too in the answer, it doesn't tell you the particular answer. It gives you the general idea of the answer. The general idea of the answer is in the pasuk of Bavur Zeh, that the validity and the truthfulness is because of the fact that this is the reason why God intervened and removed us. Then it's teaching. You see, the teaching continues. Li velo lo. It contains the idea of li velo lo. That's not what you say to him. What you say to him is this general idea of Bavur Zeh. Now it explains to you. It's talking to you. The Baal HaGadah is talking to you now. You and not him. Had he been there, he wouldn't have been redeemed. That conversation is between the one who's writing the Haggadah and the one who's conducting the Seder. That's the teaching. That is the blunting of the teeth. And it's based, where do you find the source that this is the approach? That's to be found in the answer, Bavur Zeh. The explanation of that is, Asar Hashem li, because of this God did for me when I left Egypt. And the explanation is me and not him. Had he been there, he wouldn't have been redeemed. I think part of the blunting of the teeth is based upon the fact that this person does identify with the Jewish people. He has an identification with the Jewish people. If he didn't have an identification with the Jewish people, so none of these things would have any effect upon him. But what you're really doing is you're cutting him off, you're breaking him down. The only way to break a person down is to show some kind of an inner contradiction, generally speaking. When you're trying to argue with a person over a point, to try and convince someone of some truth which the person is resisting. So sometimes the way to do so is to show that this person himself, if he maintains this point, he's involved in some kind of a contradiction somewhere else. You have to keep going until you unearth a place in which this person is actually going to have to base himself on that truth. And then show, well, you maintain that truth over here, so now if you're going to maintain this position over here, then you have to show that there's really a contradiction. So the person's in a state of contradiction. That's sort of a blunting of the teeth.
For some people,
that's sufficient. If they're logical, once you've broken them down, so they may yield. Some people don't mind. They don't feel the need to be consistent, which doesn't make sense, but there are people like that. So they're blunted, though. They don't have that same sense of vigor anymore. The idea of telling him that he wouldn't have been redeemed, it's all part of this sequence of thoughts that this is very serious. This is not just culture, nice practices that have evolved. This is very, very serious. This is the basis of our existence. So you're going to find yourself in a contradiction. You want to be part of the Jewish people, but you negate the very essence of what the Jewish people is. You're assuming that there's such a thing as the Jewish people, and it's a goodly people, and so on and so forth, and that you're taking for granted. And then you're questioning, so why do we have these things? But you're missing the point. This is the very essence of the Jewish people. Without this, there is no Jewish people. That is to say, you want to put it more specifically, had he been there, he wouldn't have been redeemed. Why wouldn't he have been redeemed? Because this is defining. These things define you as a Jew. This is part of your very definition. Indeed, you saw that in Egypt. That was the Korban Pesach. And it says that God, you'll put the blood on the doorpost and I will see. Well, you'll see the blood. Doesn't mean that God sees the blood. It means that God will take cognizance of the fact that you're involved in doing the mitzvos. So these mitzvos form the very essence of your existence. And if you deny the mitzvos, then you're denying everything. Then there's no such thing as the Jewish people. Or your idea is a false idea. So whatever it is you imagine you belong to is not the real Jewish people. With that attitude, you never would have been redeemed, meaning to say you never would have been part of this people. So you're not really part of the people. If you think about the premises by which you're living, you've created your own definition. But you've separated yourself from what the Jewish people itself regards as being the essence of their identity, which is the nation which serves God. The nation which its whole existence revolves around performing the objectively true commandments of God. That, I believe, is the refutation. Bavur zeh asar Hashem li. Because of this, God did for me, reflects the philosophy that there's nothing specific about the Jew. The Jews are not a racial entity. They're not in any way better, different, unique, separate from the people. They do not constitute a, so to speak, normal type of a nationalistic entity. All the different nationalistic entities revolve, are based upon some type of a subjective element which drew them together. Maybe it's a cultural thing, maybe it's an emotional thing, maybe it happens because of a certain place that they all occupied. That does not apply to the Jewish people. The Jewish people are an entity that's brought together for one purpose, to perform the mitzvos, to preserve the Torah and the mitzvos. That's the essence. It's not an accident. It's not like first you have an entity, you have a people, and they develop, and okay, then they work out a religion. And that's what he wants to say. But he's Jewish. It's someone who wants to affirm his Jewishness, a Jewishness without mitzvahs, a Jewishness without Torah. To him, the Jewishness is the essence. And Torah is just an accident. Mitzvahs are just an accident, which are very pleasant, they're very interesting, they're very curious. We're reversing it. The role of the mitzvos is essential. If you negate mitzvos, you negate Jewishness, And thus, you should not regard yourself as being part of this people. Because there is no other basis for Jewish identity. We're not talking about someone that has separated himself from the Jewish people and doesn't even come to the Seder. Obviously, that doesn't make any sense. A person that separated himself completely so that he wants nothing to do with the Jews is not the one that's envisioned in that pasuk. And I can prove that to you, I believe, because what is the opening words of that pasuk? The opening words of the pasuk, here it starts off with Moha Avodah Zos Lachem. What is this service to you? That's not the beginning of the pasuk. It says V'hoi Ki Yisholcha Vincha. It'll be when your children will ask you, your sons will ask you. And clearly that implies that they're still your children. There's still a relationship. However, if we're talking about someone that negated everything and walked away, is not part of the family at all, even though he's biologically Jewish, so to speak, that's not the person we're talking about. There's no breakdown as far as that's concerned. How to argue with that person is a different story. He's not included. He doesn't come to the Seder. It's someone who regards himself as being your child, because he maintains he's a child in the same way that there's a nationalistic phenomenon, but not because of mitzvahs. So for him, we're clarifying the foundations of Jewish identity. This is the foundation. The mitzvahs are the essence. And this is why we were redeemed. And anybody who doesn't share that idea is not really part of the Jewish people. This is a guide. It doesn't mean that this is the end of the discussion, and you just throw this at the so-called Russia and he'll accept it. But this is the position from which you're going to be basing yourself. Essentially, the Baal Haggadah is preparing you. Just like with all these four children, he's just preparing you. He's giving you a guide. It doesn't mean that you just say that one sentence that he says and then you move on. That doesn't make any sense. It's an outline. This, however, is where you take your stand. You take your stand on this position.
What's fantastic about